Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
All right, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. We have me, your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr., and we have another endocrinologist here, Dr. Alex Bonacase. Today we're going to be talking about the diagnosis of hypogonadism, which most people know as low T.
In men, specifically. Well, I was just going to say, Alex is definitely one of the docs who lift. So he is absolutely perfect for this. And, you know, we'll talk about a little bit of our background, but obviously he's an endocrinologist. He's also an obesity specialist, as we are. He's done, you know, a lot of sports in his day. He loves to work out. He's done natural bodybuilding and has an interest in andrology, testosterone, and has done a lot of talks and myth debunking and all sorts of stuff, especially, you know, some of the gym rats who have, you know, used steroids and things like that in the day, but also helps them get off of anabolic steroids. Right, Alex?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a pretty wide net of patients I see. And I think I get some of the more, I guess, less traditional cases, maybe guys using anabolic steroids for years that have some motivation for cessation. So I wrote a paper on harm reduction of that and try to help people come off of that. Get a lot of second opinions from some of the quack clinics, maybe guys that had good intentions, but they got put on a regimen that was totally out there and nuts. And how do we kind of help them and transition to something that's much more evidence-based and safe? So yeah, that's been kind of a clinical interest of mine for a while.
So let's go into the diagnosis of, because people say, oh, I got low testosterone. What does that actually mean? What is the clinical definition and diagnosis criteria? Yeah.
What is testosterone?
What is testosterone?
What is testosterone?
What's testosterone?
Yeah,
what is that?
Testosterone is essentially the steroid-based male sex hormone that guys, they need that for their sexual function, has a lot of benefits in metabolic health. The problem is when you're trying to define what is quote-unquote low testosterone, people view these reference ranges sometimes like other things. Like, and the analogy I use are, look at potassium. Potassium is at a very tight window for all of life, essentially, right? It's an ion. Life needs to be in a very certain, very kind of finite window. Whereas something like testosterone, you have a pretty wide range. You have multiple intricacies to how you check that on the lab assay. And we're measuring hormones in the blood that really, you know, it's a blood concentration. We're not looking at the signal transduction and differences in receptor sensitivity. So when I hear stuff like, oh, I only feel myself when my level is 800 or 600, so much of that is, I think, taken out of context and not necessarily evidence-based. So a lot of this is, I think, I'd like to kind of go over when we should be testing for it, what should we be treating, that kind of whole paradigm. Do you guys run into cases where, you know, someone's been told they have low testosterone and you've kind of inherited this and you have to kind of help educate and make sure they're doing the right thing? And maybe you're the bad guy because they've set this precedent that they're going to come see an endocrinologist or see their family doc and say, oh, this guy's going to give me testosterone. Have you guys been running into that?
Yeah, it happens to me.
Certainly, I do. You know, as you do.
It happens to me because I talk.
And we probably have a little bit of a selection bias.
I get a lot of the people that, because I talk about this on social media, they come to me because they have seen me post that, like, hey, you probably shouldn't be on it. So then they come to me to help wean them off. But I have inherited people that don't really follow me on social medias, and then they say, like, hey, I need my 200. I need my 200 milligrams of testosterone a week. I'm like, whoa there, buckaroo. your levels are 1500, like three times mine. So you probably need to not be on this. But yeah, let's go over kind of the reference ranges and diagnosis.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I think, you know, all three of us are probably a little bit of a selection bias. I mean, Spencer, like you said, for your background and as a family practice doc and social media, you know, Alex and I are endocrinologists. So just in a big healthcare setting, I get the referrals for concern of hypogonadism, and also those who have been unfortunately all too often inappropriately treated for their hypogonadism with medication or testosterone therapy when it wasn't really diagnosed appropriately. And maybe the underlying cause, if it's even true, wasn't actually diagnosed. So this is not only education for patients, but also potentially for other clinicians, maybe to get this right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there was a really nice study. I think it was Shalander Basin did this out at the VA years ago. And it was essentially something like almost every patient at the VA that had a testosterone level checked ended up getting a prescription. And so much of that was done with situations that probably are not the right reason to check testosterone. So there is some data out there that essentially when you have someone checking their testosterone, a lot of those guys end up with a prescription, whether or not it was an appropriate situation to look. Just to kind of go over the Endocrine Society guidelines and the algorithm, you know, the first step is make sure you have a good reason to check it first and all. You know, do they have signs and symptoms of hypogonadism? And I'm someone that I like the ACP statement that kind of echoed on the Endocrine Society saying that sexual dysfunction was really a big kind of line in the sand. Things like fatigue, just fatigue in itself, maybe muscle mass is less than ideal. There's a lot of things that can cause that. So to me, when a man is having sexual dysfunction, that to me is a big reason that I'm checking testosterone a lot of the times. Or maybe it's something where I get a referral like male osteoporosis and I'm looking for secondary causes of such. But I think it's wrong to kind of say every guy that goes to the doctor needs to have a testosterone checked because they don't feel 20 years old anymore, right? And that's kind of the precedent that I think kind of started with a lot of the marketing back when testosterone replacement therapy really was becoming a big thing. There was billions of dollars put into the marketing. There was a lot of direct-to-consumer marketing saying, you need your T checked. It's just a number. You know, don't settle for less than optimal. So really, as a clinician, I say, you know, make sure we have a good reason to check it. And to me, sexual dysfunction is a big reason that I check it. I will say, though, if someone has, you know, another condition or a chronic disease state that makes them more likely to have it, I will check it when there's the symptoms and the patient's maybe a candidate for it. But a lot of times I think we're going fishing when we don't really need to. And that sort of maybe gets us to the next stage where a lot of times people are checking it with these assays that have no real meaning. I know, gosh, even at a lot of academic institutions, we're still using immunoassays for total testosterone. And in the Endocrine Society guidelines, they're essentially saying these are fairly worthless assays that are not giving us a really good accurate diagnosis. So you really want too low normal, you want too low testosterone levels at the patient's morning at 8 a.m. So if it's a night shift worker, you got to think for that. Most of the time, I see that people sometimes get checked at 3 p.m. Their levels may be 200 on a random poor quality assay, and then they walk out with a prescription. That's where I think a lot of us are kind of getting in trouble, and that could be kind of a sticky situation. So I think my big thing I'm rambling about is essentially just you want to make sure you're checking when you need to, and when you do check, checking with the right evidence-based tools such as the liquid chromatography mass spec. And I don't know if you guys want to kind of take it from there in terms of a little bit of other things you do. Or
well, I would say, so LabCorp does that. You can order it from LabCorp. I'm pretty sure Quest does it. So that these academic institutes, is it because they have in-house labs? Is that what they must be using?
That was our problem. It was an in-house lab. And honestly, I think it's people want instant results, right? We have an in-house testosterone that comes back in 30 minutes, but I called the lab and it's an immunoassay and I can't really trust it. The send out takes 7 to 14 days. And, you know, I think sometimes you got to wait to get that accurate diagnosis. Otherwise you're kind of flying blind. And so I have kind of an order set I made, and I generally get the liquid chromatography mass spec as the screening test. It usually includes the free testosterone by equilibrium dialysis. If you're going to check it, it needs to be equilibrium dialysis and not analog. for confirmation, you know, if they're borderline, I'm generally also checking the sex hormone binding globulin and albumin and calculating it that way with a liquid chromatography mass spec.
You and I have talked about that a lot. I still don't even really trust even the good free testosterone assays. So I always do the sex hormone binding globulin to calculate it out. I do want to point out, you know, as we're talking to patients about this, is that, you know, really, if people have symptoms, I would really argue that people shouldn't just go and want treatment without diagnosing the underlying true cause of the symptoms. And if it really is hypogonadism that you'll get into the diagnosis, we really need to know what's causing the hypogonadism. You shouldn't just walk out with medication without knowing, because there are lots of secondary causes, from hypothalamic pituitary disorders to, you know, we're going to have a whole segment on obesity, functional hypogonadism, and all that stuff. You got to know what's causing problems, and not just, you know, people always say, oh, doctors are, you know, giving us medicine and they're not even diagnosing our root cause. Well, no, we are saying we have to, you really, really want to know the root cause, because you don't want to miss something for sure. And, you know, just getting testosterone therapy for an inappropriate diagnosis, maybe that makes you feel better because it's has a drug effect, but that's not getting to the underlying issue, and you might totally miss something important.
Yeah, I do want to mention, make sure you get, I want to make sure people are fasting too. Eating any types of foods can acutely lower your total testosterone, and then obviously doing it later in the day. And then I do want to mention the issue is also these, I would call them quacks. Mm-hmm. They're opening up these testosterone clinics. The way they make money is by giving out testosterone prescriptions, and then people have to pay to keep coming back. Cash, mind you. I think there's going to be a big crackdown, and at some point the DEA is a little bit backed up due to opioids and all that type of stuff. But I think we're getting through that. I think they're going to start cracking down on these testosterone clinics. These places prey on the unknowing. Those are the most people that I get. They're like, yeah, I went to one of these testosterone clinics. Yeah, I wasn't fasting. Yeah, it was 2 p.m. They only did one test right there in the lab, probably with the amino assay, as Dr. Bonacay said, discussed, not even accurate. And then I walked out with a 200 milligram prescription of testosterone cypionate or whatever per week. And now they're coming in with a hematocrit, their blood super thick. And in fact, I saw one person had a stroke back when I was in the clinic in this case. But anyway, just a quick tangent. Make sure you're fasting, by the way, doing this, and you should do it twice.
It's an important tangent. I mean, I had another guy that did have a stroke or had a cardiovascular event, and then from one of those clinics, and then they checked every lab except a prolactin. Guy kept getting worse, and you can see where I'm going with this. He didn't need testosterone. He needed cabergoline, right? He had a prolactinoma that they checked thousands of dollars worth of labs except a prolactin, and they just said, you need testosterone, guy feels good, starts having vision changes, comes to me for a second opinion, took about 5 seconds to realize what was going on. Long story short, cabergoline shrunk the macroadenoma, and it was that was a great example of just how dangerous it can be to just throw meds around without a cause, especially when people don't know what they're doing. So I agree 100% with what you're saying.
And I feel like we've all had those stories.
Yeah, Casey, you've seen hemochromatosis.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've seen hemochromatosis, I'm pretty sure. I've seen HIV.
So to be clear, yeah. So we're talking about not even the people that are just, you know, kind of inappropriately diagnosed with hypogonadism and who don't have hypogonadism. We're talking about people who really do have hypogonadism, but they have treatable underlying issues that need to be addressed. And then they just leave with testosterone, and their pituitary growth continues to grow. Their hemochromatosis gets worse, you know, whatever it is. Their obesity, sleep apnea, continues to be unaddressed, that we'll get to. So, all right. So let's get back to diagnosis and some of the causes of the different types of low testosterone or actual hypogonadism.
Yeah. So, you know, let's say that you have a low testosterone and the reference range, and I'll go the way that they found the reference ranges, I'll be very brief on this, but there's essentially, there were studies where they created harmonized reference ranges of nearly 10,000 men. They looked at these giant cohorts. They used standardized liquid chromatography mass spec assays, and they equated harmonized reference ranges essentially for most men. And I will say, we get this comment a lot, you know, the reference range is 264 to 916 about, and I you guys might have heard this too. A lot of people say, well, that's for an older person, I'm younger. If you go to the JCEM article where they did harmonized reference ranges, the 264 to 916 range was actually for men between ages 19 and 39. And when you looked through the different cohorts stratified by age, it actually didn't change as much as you would expect. So that's just kind of an anecdote and or a side piece of data to kind of say it's not that they're using ranges for elderly men. So after you've verified that they have a low testosterone, you want to repeat it with an 8 a.m., as Spencer was saying. And I additionally get things like I'll get the LH and FSH per the guidelines. These are the pituitary hormones, and you want to see, is it secondary or primary? And what I mean by that is it the pituitary and hypothalamus are not signaling appropriately to the testes, or is it that the testes are not responding to appropriate pituitary stimulation? So what part is not working? Is it the pituitary and hypothalamus, or is it the actual testes? That's important too, because different areas, different disease states, right? We get a prolactin because we want to rule out prolactinoma. That's a very common cause of hypogonadism, because high prolactin will lower that luteinizing hormone and then therefore lower your testosterone. As Casey was saying, you know, get a ferritin or try to just make sure they don't have a huge concern for hemochromatosis, because that absolutely can cause both primary or secondary hypogonadism. Those are the big things. And then this isn't necessarily part of the algorithm, but I get a lot of sleep studies, because I've just seen it. Sleep apnea is a plague. It's ubiquitous. And you generally see, will that in itself give you hypogonadism? Probably not, but I just find that it's so ubiquitous and can cause a lot of the symptoms too, and certainly is a risk factor for exacerbating the polycythemia. So just as you can see, that's just simple lab tests. We rule out prolactinoma, we rule out hemochromatosis. We make sure to say, is it primary? You know, is it something where the testicles aren't working and they have either a testicular injury or something like genetic disorder like Klinefelter's, or is it a pituitary disorder? And we have to be thinking about that. So being systematic in the diagnosis is essential. Otherwise, you're flying blind and just throwing medicine around without knowing what's going on.
Yeah, so for those who are listening, make sure you get a thorough examination. I would recommend an endocrinologist. I know people don't like them because they don't give out the testosterone as much. That's what people say. They're stingy. They use the reference ranges. What about this? Here's a question. People will say, just two decades ago, our average testosterone levels were whatever, 500, 600, and now the average is lower. I would argue it's secondary to what we're going to have another podcast on, is obesity and metabolic syndrome. But is there any truth to that, and that's our average levels are starting to decline?
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what Alex says, but I don't know if there's any recent reviews on it. But like you said, you know, we have more obesity, we have more sleep apnea, we have, by the way, other causes of functional hypogonadism like opioids, right? Maybe more alcohol and cannabis use potentially, poor nutrition, sleep stuff. There's also a concern there may be something about the endocrine disrupting chemicals in society, and the Endocrine Society has done a lot of work on that. I don't know how absolutely true that is, but also the data have, you know, been accumulated and updated. So it's kind of hard to say, well, yeah, now we have more data to show what these reference ranges are compared to what the averages were, and we have better lab testing like Alex was talking about earlier. What do you think about that, Alex? That's a good question.
I think I agree completely. My thought, and I'm not sure on the exact data, but I feel like, one, it's an assay issue too, because I do think total testosterones have decreased as a population because, well, obesity has increased as a population. So we'll get into that in another podcast, but I do think a lot of this is functional. Again, sometimes people are checking when they're not supposed to. I do think there's something to the environmental things in terms of endocrine disruptors or even just stress, right? People are more stressed than they've ever been in the last few years. So I think it's largely a combination of functional factors, and then maybe just people are looking at total when A lot of people have chronic disease states like obesity that are going to reduce the total testosterone, but they might not necessarily have true biochemical hypogonadism. So I agree completely with that.
So one of the most common things that I see other than obesity related hypogonadism, I see a lot of chronic dieters. And this causes a secondary hypogonadism. Basically, the brain's not communicating with your balls, your testicles. So in fact, I did a natural bodybuilding competition before, and you see it in natural bodybuilders when they post their testosterone. And mine averages somewhere around 500 to 600 nanograms per deciliter. And when I did the bodybuilding competition, I was sucked down as much as I could, and probably not as lean as I even am capable of getting. But my total went down to around 200, 250 or something like that. And I felt it, just no libido. Whether I had erectile issues, I'll leave that up to the listener, whether I did
or not. Good God.
The people want to know,
Spencer. People want to know.
Holy, oh my
God. No, but actually.
Well, hey, you know what?
Within two weeks of eating normally, boom, went back up. And when I talk to these patients that are put on testosterone, it turns out they were doing it while they're dieting. Do not get your testosterone checked while you're dieting hard. It just makes no sense.
Well, and we've all done this.
Your body thinks it's starving.
Yeah. I mean, what if if I'm seeing a guy that's 30 and maybe he drank too much the night before and slept really bad, his testosterone's going to be in the toilet the next day, right? So that's not a situation to make a diagnosis, acute illness. And well, you know, what you're referring to, it's totally that, relative energy deficiency syndrome, what they used to kind of almost like the male version of hypothalamic amenorrhea.
Yeah.
The way my mentors always explained it.
I was going to say that.
Yeah. Of course. My mentors always explained it to me is like, your body's kind of saying you're not in the best state to reproduce right now, right? Energy's low. You're kind of in a conservation mode. And so I have a lot of patients, I've seen it due to alcohol. I've seen it due to marathon runners is kind of the classic vignette. Certainly bodybuilders. That's why the natural competitors that you see them with a lot more atrophy, I think a lot than the enhanced guys, because they're getting hypogonadal, they're in such a chronic energy deficient state, it's not really normal to be able to do that. So yeah, that's an excellent point. And I do think, like, I even see it with night shift workers. The guy's worked all night and he's checking it at 8 a.m. but for him that's his midnight, and of course it's going to be like 160 or something. And so yeah, I think that's kind of the art, and that's an excellent point. So when are you going to do another show, though, is what I want to know.
God. I never want to do that again, but we've all done that.
I don't think I'm going to either, man.
Nah, we've all done it. I always like to tease around that, I wouldn't mind just, getting a little bit lean and just hopping up on stage for fun, but I'm not going to win anything doing that. But, as a wrestler, and I know, we've all done some sports. Alex, you didn't wrestle, did you?
No. I get my ass kicked.
you cut down for bodybuilding, and all three of us, docs who lift, I know we've all been falsely accused of using anabolic steroids. I was falsely accused when I was 10 years old before I even went through puberty. I still don't have any chest hair, but
that's
we've all
so short.
Cut down what, the chest hair. What does that have anything to do with?
No, being so short, it fuses your growth plates quicker. The androgens, that's part of growing up. If young kids,
you think that's why they thought
their growth? I don't know.
You think that's why they? Anyways, that's not the point. But the point is that we've all experienced probably a little bit of functional hypogonadism, because while Spencer was a heavyweight and he never cut weight in an iota in his life, doesn't know what it's like at all. And the rest of us, had to cut weight every weekend. I remember, we were lean and mean and we're cutting weight. And boy, I was 20, 21, 22. I didn't have much of a libido when that was happening. I can tell you that for free. So absolutely. I'm sure, all of us wrestlers in college had relative hypogonadism, but we still went out and beat each other up. So, we were all right.
I think that's the main thing. I think the highlights for the diagnosis are check when there's a good reason to. Don't check for the sake of checking, because you will find something and not be sure how to interpret it, and stuff gets prescribed when it doesn't need to. And then if you do find that they have low testosterone, or say you're a patient and you're seeing one of these less evidence-based clinics and they say you have low testosterone, you definitely need to advocate to see someone that knows what they're doing and they can figure out why is it low, because the worst thing you can do is have a basically misdiagnosis and miss something where there's a driver to cause the hypogonadism that's not being addressed. And so that would be
a big holistic big medicine. You know,
what about the ADAM questionnaire? Any of these questionnaires work? Are these any of these questionnaires?
The ADAMS questionnaire and all that stuff like that?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think so. I think the urologists use that a lot. And I've seen literature where they're talking about, I saw one paper saying that symptoms occur when testosterone's under 400, according to the ADAM questionnaire. But I've taken the ADAM questionnaire, and according to that, I have really bad low testosterone and need treatment or something like that. So, I mean, I don't know. I think that they initially came out with some of these, but I think to me, I really like that ACP article where they really highlighted sexual dysfunction. So fatigue without sexual dysfunction, I'm very hesitant to say that's due to testosterone.
Think holistically, you know, people, all of us need to be, and patients and doctors and nurses and everybody need to think holistically. I mean, there are people who have, they think they have hypogonadism. They actually have hypothyroidism if we're going to stick to hormone stuff. But boy, how often is it sleep issues? Between sleep apnea and just poor sleep, I always tell people, half the people who come into the endocrine clinic to figure out if their fatigue is from hormones, it ends up being a sleep issue, which often causes hormone issues in addition to the symptoms. So, you know, we got to think holistically and think, well, what else is going on? And don't take medicine unless you have a real understanding of what the cause is and if that underlying cause can be treated. Absolutely. Should we talk about any testosterone replacement therapy thoughts for people who do have hypogonadism and need to be on testosterone therapy?
Yeah, and I think we can all give kind of our own spin. And so I think if I'm being by the book, you know, the Endocrine Society guidelines, they do list a lot of the, I would call them kind of less traditional modalities. They list them as acceptable options. And they do mention things like pellets and all those things. My personal bias, I stick to intramuscular or subcutaneous testosterone cipionate. I personally think that's the most physiologic. I actually really like the subcutaneous route. I think that there's nice literature about more stable pharmacokinetics dosed weekly, particularly enanthate, but you can certainly do testosterone cipionate sub-Q. Gels, I'm not a huge fan of gels, mainly because I think back to some of my rotations and I've seen some precocious puberty where dad is on Androgel and there's kids and there's some transdermal absorption or maybe the wife is presenting to endocrine clinic with hirsutism now. So I think that needs to be explained if that's something that's done. But I am just someone, I usually stick to testosterone cipionate. I pretty much do it weekly. I know the guidelines say start with every 2 weeks, but at least from the pharmacokinetic data, I feel like that medium chain ester tends to run out a little sooner. So I do it weekly at a lower dose. Sometimes I start as low as 50 milligrams. I generally don't go over 100 milligrams a week for guys. I think beyond that, you kind of have some peaks and valleys that might be suboptimal. And I don't know.
Yeah,
what about you guys?
I have some thought. You know, so I like, you know, so I definitely like that, you know, the trade name of Zyosted, if we're allowed to do that.
Oh, yeah.
We're not getting paid by them, by the way. But it's
a cool name.
The coverage, that's the weekly subcutaneous that's approved testosterone enanthate that you mentioned. And it does very well and it has great data. But the coverage isn't great for people. And of course the insurance companies want the cheap intramuscular. I actually don't like that one because I can't imagine giving myself an intramuscular shot. Oh my God, that sounds horrible to me. So I actually am a little bit more of a big fan of the transdermal gels and patches, because to me that sets people up for a little bit more of a physiological level, you know, as opposed to like big peaks and valleys. You know, the intramuscular stuff. But certainly you're right. You can't let the gel get on kids or females who don't want it. There's one type of testosterone therapy that I wish we had better access to here. And that is I'm drawing a blank on it's the trade names of
undecanoate.
Undecanoate. And it's been studied a lot in the other parts of the world, actually for obesity associated hypogonadism it seems to have very nice stable levels for several months. Do you have any experience with that, Alex? Because I've wanted to use it, but you have to do it in the clinic. And I, for whatever reason, I just haven't been able to get it going.
I think Europe is doing that a lot more. I know that some urologists do it. I admit I haven't used it before, and maybe I'm scared off by the pulmonary oil emboli syndrome warning that it has. You have to observe them in the clinic. Yeah, the reason you have to observe them is because you have potential for that cough and kind of oil emboli syndrome just due to the sheer amount of oil that the injection is. I don't know. I sort of have the philosophy. I like formulations that have a little bit shorter of a half-life because I can adjust it if I need to. I'm kind of stuck with it if we do that. So, but I haven't used it. It might be something great. I just haven't really personally used it. What about you guys?
I use Cipionate subcutaneously, actually a few times a week. I cut up the doses and I found that, people do well. Yeah. You use the larger gauge to draw it up. You can put on the smaller needle. And it's one of those things where it's like, well, you try to get as physiological as possible. If you want to do that, you probably use the gel. So what we discuss, testosterone follows a diurnal curve. So it's highest in the morning and goes lower. That's why we have to check it in the morning. So most physiological probably would be a nice little bit in the morning, and then it gets a little bit less at night, and then every day you would take it. So the larger doses, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if it really matters, but I have found that smaller doses a couple times a week, because it's subcutaneous and doesn't hurt like the intramuscular, I've done really well with that. And I would never, ever do once every other week. People get these peaks and valleys that just, they feel like crap. Yeah. And I get, I don't know, I only do sub-Q now, and I do Cipionate, and it gets to be around 100, maybe up to 150 milligrams, but I monitor them closely. I've seen really bad problems with
the pellets. Yeah, I was going to say the pellets we all are against.
If they give you too much, you have to go surgically.
I've seen gluteal abscesses. I've seen, infections.
You have to surgically remove
granulomas. Yeah.
But also if they were to get a high hematocrit, so testosterone can increase your hematocrit, makes your blood thicker. I've seen people to where it's like, oh my gosh, this is like dangerous. One guy had a stroke, and the only thing they could figure out was that his testosterone was enormously high and his hematocrit was high. The hematologist attributed it to testosterone. And I don't want to scare anybody. It's relatively rare. But that was the one thing that I saw is that the pellets. So I never recommend pellets.
Well, also, talk about not scaring people. If done appropriately, I mean, there was just a meta-analysis of they're not long-term studies, but a meta-analysis of relatively short to moderate-term studies. When it's done appropriately, it's pretty safe. And in fact, probably has benefits. If someone has true hypogonadism that should be on testosterone replacement therapy, it's probably all the benefits outweigh the risks. To your point of the subcutaneous, I do have some guys who we do actually the subcutaneous shot every day. I have some guys that do that as they prefer. In endocrinology clinics, of course, we have so many people on insulin and other daily injections that, that doesn't maybe seem as big of a deal. But on the other hand, I definitely have people kind of counter to what you guys said about the every 2 weeks. I hate that personally. It doesn't sound good to me, but I have people who don't mind it. They don't go too high. They don't feel bad when they're in their low right before their shots, and they would prefer the, every 2 weeks. And also this is a whole nother topic, but transgender patients, they don't mind doing that either. So everyone's different, and we got to treat people like individuals and do what's best for them.
And I think that's where the sub-Q data came from, was actually like the trials were in transgender patients and they did really well.
Yeah. So anything else you think we need to talk about? Do you think people care about, how we monitor or anything like that? We really should leave that up to the physicians and the patients themselves, but I don't know if patients are interested in what we're monitoring to make sure they're safe.
I agree with Spencer. I watch the, if there's an indication to watch the PSA, it has to be individualized patient by patient, but that's something. And then I watch the hematocrit pretty closely. And the first sign of polycythemia disproportionate to the amount of therapy, I'm sending them for a sleep study. It's wrong if you see a doc just saying, okay, donate blood and just don't even think about it more. You might donate blood or do a phlebotomy as a, mitigation of the acute polycythemia, but you need to figure out why it's happening and not just blindly say, dump your blood every couple of weeks. That's crazy. So, I think that, and that is kind of a board question almost. You know, if you start a guy on testosterone, they get this huge bump in their hematocrit. It's almost always sleep apnea, and it's ubiquitous. So,
absolutely.
All right, I think that's it for now. Until next time, thanks, Dr. Bonacase.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.